Welcome to We The Podcast, the show about how the people outside of the billionaire and millionaire class, you know, most of us, engage the economy. There are 157 million women in the United States, more than half of our population. These women are of all kinds of different backgrounds, races, gender identities, sexual orientation, religious background, ethnicity, very diverse. They come from different regions of the country. They do all kinds of jobs. Some are doctors, engineers, CEOs, teachers, activists, artists, all kind of people. No two women, no two people have exactly the same story. But there's one thing that all women do share, the pink tax. That's right. Women pay more for everything from clothes and hygiene products to health insurance to car repairs to dry cleaning than men. And we're not just talking about a few cents here or there. The state of California did a study a few years ago and found that the pink tax costs women more than $1,300 a year on average, all while they're being paid less for doing equal work. The fact is that women experience the economy differently than men do, not just on the job. In the doctor's office, they're blocked from important services and have to pay more to be covered. And when they're looking for housing, they often are turned away or discriminated against. It's not easy being a woman in America. So when we look at these issues, it's important that we not just consider how certain policies affect women. We also have to look at how exclusion of women from the decision-making process weakens the overall product. Some wise person once said to me, whatever is done for us without us is being done to us. Terry O'Neill calls this the gender lens, and she recommends putting it on everything we do. Terry is the president of the National Organization for Women, one of our oldest and best feminist organizations in the country. She stopped by my office to talk about how we can put a gender lens on a number of issues and how we can get women the equality they so richly deserve and have been fighting for every step of the way.
Women would be so well served by a focus on economic inequality, on income inequality, on wealth inequality. If we look at disparities, and that is what the economic justice part of the progressive movement, I think, has done so well, looking at those disparities, looking at what it means to actual people's lives when you have income inequality just out of control and wealth inequality. And then look at other types of disparities. This would be putting a gender lens on that inequality. Health outcomes for women across racial lines are dramatically unequal. Even if you control for socioeconomic level, income, and education levels, African American women have far poorer health outcomes on breast cancer than white women. Mm-hmm. And the researchers are now saying, what they're saying is it's connected to cortisol.
Yeah.
Stress, the stress hormones, the stress levels you feel. And just think of stress in these, like this. So Melanie Campbell was telling me
that
there was a study done. African American women were asked, what is the highest consideration for you in deciding when and whether to have children, when you're going to start your family? The number one answer was, can I afford it? Am I financially secure? And that's actually pretty consistent across racial lines. For African American women, the number two consideration, can I keep an adolescent safe in interactions with police or in the community?
My dad told me, he said, look, do not talk back to the police.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they are wrong, but they will kill you. My father said to me, they will kill you. And I looked away and I started to smile like, yeah, right. He grabbed me by the collar and said, no, I am kidding. I'm not kidding. They will kill you, son.
Oh, boy.
And there won't be much nothing any of us can do about it. And I remember it like it was yesterday because he was just that serious about it.
No, and yeah.
And I think, you know, I don't think he meant for this, but it kind of made us a little scared of the police. Well, we sure didn't want to talk to them, and we sure as hell didn't like them.
Yes, exactly. Well, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of good reasons for that. And so if you're constantly living this kind of stress and anxiety about keeping your family together, about keeping your family members safe, obviously the health outcomes are going to be different. So we need to, you know, attack those disparities. And I think economic justice issues are absolutely at the foundation of a lot of what's wrong. But the one time when this country started doing economic justice right was also the time when we had the highest levels of racism, of lynchings, of Jim Crow, and of vicious restrictions on women, including white women's pure freedom, just ability to live their life, right? Back in the 1940s and 50s, you couldn't get credit. You couldn't sign your own lease. You couldn't leave an abusive situation because you couldn't sign a lease on your own, all of this stuff. So the one time we know that economic justice alone is not going to get us to racial justice or gender justice, unless we combine the three of them. Mm-hmm. We could go back to the 1950s, and this is and quite frankly, I was a kid in the 1950s, and my mom, rest her soul, was not a happy camper. She did her best, but she did not feel valued as a human being. Right. And here she was, upper middle class white woman.
Right, right. Put a gender lens on the repeal of the Affordable Care Act for me.
Oh, it's devastating to women. It's absolutely devastating to women. And I say that as someone who was, quite frankly, very, very angry about the machinations, the compromises that were made around
no public option.
Well, the no public option, and then the no public funding for abortion care and restrictions on private funding for abortion care.
Oh, yeah,
so I was
sure.
Very upset about that.
The whole Hyde Amendment debate.
Exactly,
right.
That whole thing and the Stupak Amendment and all that.
Sure.
So putting that to the side for one moment, what the ACA does do is the essential health benefits.
Sure.
Okay, essential health benefits is a very innocuous little list of 10, roughly between 6 and 10 things, like, I don't know, hospitalization and doctor visits and mental health care and maternity care and, oh, preventive care. Preventive care is the cool part. If you go in the regulations, you'll have this list of all these prevention things for adults, men and women. As a list of all these prevention things for kids, you know, your vaccinations and so forth. And for adults, it's the annual diabetes check and the heart disease and so forth. And then you have a list of women's preventive things, which were the result of my senator, Barbara Mikulski, because
right.
I live
and
in
you're
Maryland.
You're talking about like cervical screenings?
This is it.
These kind of things that really prolong life.
Exactly. The mammograms, the mm-hmm. cervical cancer screenings, the osteoporosis screenings, which
oh,
disproportionately
yeah. big deal.
For
Very
women.
Big deal. Mm-hmm.
And birth control.
Sure.
These are just the ordinary things, and lactation training, and prenatal care, all of these preventive care
now,
things.
Now, see, you got some guys who will say, well, why should I pay for that? I'm not going to have a baby or anything like that. Why should I have to pay for that?
Well, you know, it's the same thing as why should I have to pay for the military? I'm never going to be in the military, and I'm not going to go off and shoot somebody.
But you don't have the prostate, do you?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't have to worry about that. So
yeah, yeah.
What about
so,
that? Yeah.
Yeah, there is this idea of, you know, insurance supposed to be kind of
it's
a
the pool.
Risk.
It's the whole
yeah.
the whole idea is
you know.
And you know, think about it this way. Think about today for you, tomorrow for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
We pay into the pool because when we get sick, we're going to need all the money that's in the pool. And on any given year, only 25% of us will need the money that's in the pool. But at some point, we're going to be in that 25%. So you
sure.
always pay in so that you'll have it.
So put a gender lens on Social Security.
Oh, women work a lifetime at unequal pay.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, by the time we get to our retirement years, we are going to have a lower Social Security payment because, you know, your Social Security benefit is based on your work history. It's wage replacement. It's a wage replacement insurance scheme. So we get to the end of our working life, and that you look back 35 years, you average out your wages. Oops, the average woman works in the paid workforce only 28 years because she's been forced out in some years during her career to engage
family
in
issues.
Unpaid care.
Right.
So, family issues. So she's got, she on 35 years, she's got like 5 years of 0000.
Right.
So that's part of why her Social Security payment is lower. Then on top of that, she's worked a lifetime at unequal pay, and she has higher expenses during her lifetime than men do because she's more likely to have had financial responsibility for children and financial responsibility for her elders.
Right.
So she's doing all this unpaid care. She's coming out of pocket for their health care and for their other needs, and she's not getting the money in. She gets to the end of her life, she has a much, much lower nest egg. She doesn't have her own savings.
Right.
And then she has a lower Social Security. So we desperately need expanded Social Security benefits, especially for women.
And she may live longer.
And she may live longer.
So she may need income stream.
Exactly. Longer. Exactly. Mm-hmm. An income stream that you can live on. There, you know, quite honestly, it's humiliating.
Sure.
For a woman to move into her daughter's basement.
Yeah.
And you know, it matters. We're the wealthiest country in the world. Why would we create an economic system that causes people to feel humiliated?
Well, let's flip back toward the beginning of the life cycle.
Yes.
Put a gender lens on Social Security, and while you're at it, why not paid maternity and sick leave?
Exactly. Every other industrialized country has paid leave. It doesn't make any sense that we don't. And quite frankly, I'm the CEO of a small organization. I have a very small staff of 15. We have strong maternity, but actually parental leave policies. And it's not just parental leave, it's caregiving leave.
Sure.
So it's not just to care for your own children, it's to care for people who depend on you.
Mm-hmm.
So we have these strong policies, and guess what? We do fine. You just have to do your staffing structure in a certain way. You can afford to have this pay. And by the way, some studies are showing that that more generous leave policies create more loyalty on the part of employees.
Yeah.
And lower turnover, and that actually ends up in being higher profits
for
the company.
Well, you know, we did learn that retraining a worker,
right,
is like an average of $12,000 per worker, particularly if you're talking about like even low-skilled workers.
Yes.
And that means that if you just give them a little more money, that means you can give them $12,000 more.
Yes.
And break even.
And still break even. Yes, exactly.
So, you know,
exactly.
One of the things the Republicans really seem like they're just absolutely obsessed with is repealing the Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
And you were telling me earlier about how in Texas, we know what the outcome is going to be because we have an example.
Yeah. I mean, look, in 2011, Texas passed this like series or omnibus bills defunding Planned Parenthood and all of the Title X family planning clinics. And also passed the clinic shutdown law that was subsequently ruled unconstitutional.
Now, the shutdown law, is that the law that said that if you're going to perform an abortion at this clinic, it's got to have this... all this equipment
exactly.
that actually isn't necessary but does drive up costs drives up costs in a prohibitive way.
In a prohibitive way, just puts the clinics out of business. Also required doctors to have admitting privileges in public hospitals where the public hospitals were not giving admitting privileges to doctors who perform abortions. So just really the whole purpose of it was to shut down the clinics and make them unavailable to women. That was in 2011. Since 2011, the maternal death rate in Texas has doubled. We are sitting here in 2017. And in just that short period of time, the maternal death rate in Texas has doubled as a result of Texas's harsh anti-reproductive health care policies. So I call those policies that kill women. And don't tell me that that's pro-life.
Well, you wrote an op-ed in the...
In the Hill.
Hill newspaper.
The Hill newspaper, yeah.
Where you really expanded on, if you're going to call yourself pro-life, let's talk about what that really means.
What that really means, yeah, exactly. It means not repealing the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
It means keeping the ACA and improving it and maybe adding a public option and eventually getting to a single-payer health care. But because you want to have that preventive care, the full range of reproductive health care services for women. If you're pro-life, you will support the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, the FACE Act, which
mm-hmm.
stops the bombings and the terrorist attacks on abortion clinics. If you're pro-life, you will support The Each Woman Act, which broadens out the access that women have to early reproductive health care, including early abortion care as well as birth control. Those are all the things that keep women healthier and give women access to comprehensive reproductive health care. Those are authentically pro-life policies. Now, if you push to overturn Roe v. Wade, 77% of the people in this country want Roe v. Wade to remain the law of the land. And we know that after Roe was decided, maternal death rates plummeted in the 1970s and 1980s after Roe. So we know that reinstating abortion bans by overturning Roe versus Wade, that's a policy that kills women. Mm-hmm. And a policy that kills women cannot be called pro-life.
Let me just ask this. So one of the things that you all are working on is voting rights. And a lot of people
yes.
don't think of voting rights as like a women's or men's thing. It's just voting rights. But actually there are gender dimensions to voting.
There is a big gender dimension to voting. What we're seeing is that these voter suppression tactics that are focused, that are targeted on communities of color, like mm-hmm. what we saw in North Carolina,
right.
what we saw in Texas, in fact, those kinds of voter suppression strategies disproportionately impact women. Just look at voter ID laws. If your current ID has to match your birth certificate,
right.
that has a hugely disproportionate impact on women because women change their name when they get married and, no judging, when they get divorced and remarried. So you may have to produce not only your birth certificate, but your marriage certificate and maybe even your divorce certificate. And all of this takes time. Women work a lifetime at unequal pay and are overrepresented in low-wage jobs, or it's hard to take time off from work to go get that documentation so you can comply with the voter ID laws. So right there, that putting that gender lens on it, and we know that women of color, when they are allowed to vote, they vote for inclusive, generous policy. They vote for candidates that will promote progressive, inclusive policies that are good for all of us.
Well, you know, while we're on this topic of, you know, applying the gender lens to different issues, housing is another one that comes to mind for me because
yes.
there's a guy named Matthew Desmond who wrote a book called Evicted, and he points out in the book that look, if you look at the mass incarceration, you have a huge disproportionate number of black men who are imprisoned.
Right.
But if you look at housing policy and evictions, huge numbers of black and brown women are evicted.
And
he said if you look at it the whole package,
yes.
black men are locked up, black women are locked out. And he goes on to point out that rent eats first. So, you know, you
yes.
got all these families where this enormous percentage of the family budget is devoted to rent.
To rent alone, yes.
And if you got a bad rental history, the price only goes up because the bad landlords know they got you.
That's right.
And this is often something that women face. Women of all colors, really.
Women of all colors, but then when you talk about the racial difference among women of who gets overrepresented in the lower wage jobs and rent comes first,
mm-hmm.
you've got that whole problem of working a lifetime at unequal pay where your expenses are higher over your lifetime precisely
oh, wait a minute.
Because of that.
Then there's the study called the pink tax, which says
yes.
that women
yes.
pay more for everything.
Yes.
Including dry cleaning and car repairs.
Yes.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, it's tough out there being a woman, right? This is not easy, man.
It is not easy.
I mean, it's hard.
It's really not. It's really not. And I think the most important thing is that all these women's issues, we really need to go beyond thinking of women's issues as just about their reproductive health care, although that is key.
Sure.
It is absolutely key, but it's not the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's also general health care. It's also the disparities between black women and white women in outcomes related to breast cancer, but also related to diabetes and heart disease and blood pressure. And you find more women of color who experience comorbidities, like
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Conditions like that.
Then they're sick with more than one thing.
Being sick with more than one thing, which guess what? Then that means that you're missing more work.
Yeah.
And you're missing more work, and eventually you're not getting the hours that you need if you're an hourly worker.
And your pay goes,
and your stress goes up, and then the condition gets worse.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, it's been really a pleasure talking with you, and I want to just thank National Organization of Women. How long have you all been fighting for justice out here?
50 years.
50 years.
Last year, we celebrated our 50th anniversary. We were created, and you know, we were created in 1966 by women who came out of the labor movement, the civil rights movement, and the peace movement.
Mm-hmm.
And what they said they wanted was we need an organization that does class and race and sex.
Mm-hmm.
And they in the 60s they weren't getting it in the civil rights movement, they weren't getting that in the peace movement or the labor movement. And they wanted also to be able to rise into leadership in their organizations. In the 60s that really wasn't available. So they created that, but even back then in the 60s they wanted the interconnection of race and class and gender to be recognized. And so we're still working for that today.
Well, bless them for their vision.
Yeah.
And thank you for carrying on that struggle.
Yeah.
And just want to say it's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Congressman. It's always great to talk with you.
Terry's right. By putting the gender lens on everything we do, we can see how much more work needs to be done and one day end discrimination like the pink tax and so many other unfairnesses. And it's because of organizations like National Organization for Women that we've made the progress we've made. They have been dogged. They have fought back. They have never, never given up the fight. But it's going to take us all working together to achieve justice. And I know women like Terry O'Neill and all the women who led our nation in the Women's March and so many others who fight every day for equality and inclusion will be on the front lines leading the way. For this episode of We the Podcast, this is Keith Ellison, and I'll see you next time. But I need you to do me a favor. Head on over to iTunes and rate, review, and subscribe to We the Podcast. This episode of We the Podcast was produced by Abby Shanfield, Kari Moe, Zach Freed, and Brett Morrow. See you next time.